TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Fukushima, 5 years later. If you followed the internet news on the unfolding disaster that began in Fukushima on May 11, 2011, you are familiar with one voice for sure, Arne Gundersen of Fair Winds Associates. He brought all the important detail of the operation of nuclear power plants into the discussion. Gundersen is a licensed reactor operator and managed and coordinated projects at 70 nuclear power plants in the U.S. After 20 years as nuclear engineer and executive, Gundersen was fired from his job with Nuclear Energy Services in 1990. When he became a whistleblower on the lack of nuclear safety. Gundersen served as an expert witness in the investigation of the Three Mile Island accident and testified on the serious flaws of the Vermont Yankee, San Onofre, and Diablo Canyon nuclear power plants. Both Vermont Yankee and San Onofre are now in shutdown. In 2008, Gundersen's wife Maggie formed the nonprofit Fair Winds Energy Education. Their website features videos and podcasts, as well as blog posts on current events, expert witness reports on nuclear safety issues, a book list, media coverage, and much more. The website is widely used in Japan, and thanks to dedicated volunteer translators, is available in 4 languages. And this radio program gives you a sense of the work done through that website. On the 5th anniversary of the Fukushima accident, Arne Gundersen is spending a month in Japan to assess the status of the cleanup and follow-up. He comes to Japan at a very crucial moment, even though polls show that at least 70% of Japanese do not want the nuclear power plants reopened that were shut down 5 years ago. The Abe government is determined to put many of them back online and has begun the process. And to make things worse, the Japanese government is planning to burn plutonium mixed with uranium in their aging reactors, a practice that has been abandoned in the U.S. due to the high risk. Gundersen was invited to speak to community groups and NGOs across Japan. He's traveling with a group of scientists and a representative of NIRS, the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. Mary Olson plans to focus on the health effects on women and children. All research and experience show that women and children are especially vulnerable to radiation. As I'm preparing this radio program for broadcast, Gundersen and Olson have arrived in Japan at the first stop, Fukushima Prefecture. Like all visitors to the area, they came equipped with their own Geiger counters. Gundersen spoke with Maggie Gundersen at Fair Winds to phone in his first report. He had taken the bullet train to Fukushima City and drove by car to some of the ghost towns that surround the power plant.
I'll tell you, the devastation's just awful. You go by beautiful homes and they're abandoned. You know, there's snow in the mountains and there's, you know, the driveways aren't plowed and the places are beginning to get run down. And in their front yard, you'll see dozens of bags, and each bag weighs a ton filled with dirt. There's 30 million bags weighing 30 million tons of radioactive dirt and radioactive tree leaves and everything. And then, of course, all the rice paddies are loaded with plastic bags full of radioactive material, so they're not going to be, you know, growing rice there for a long time. Then we found a parking lot at a supermarket that had a large radioactive source right in the middle of the parking lot that people were walking over and driving over. It was loaded with a black radioactive dust. So just wherever you go, it's everywhere. And every house we saw was abandoned. Then you get into a small town that is open during the day for the construction people. And then they close down when the construction people leave. Wherever you go, there's constant reminders that everything's radioactive. Big orange signs on the side of the road saying, you know, this area is not under construction, but this area is being decontaminated. Then we go to areas that were complete, and they're radioactive as all heck. So as soon as they clean it, it rains and it becomes contaminated again.
Why is that? Why does the rain bring it in again? Is that washing down from the mountains or the hillsides, or is that washing from the site, or is it radioactivity still exuding from the site that's being redeposited?
Well, they're only cleaning 20 feet on every side of the road. So all the dust and debris that's up in the forests is being blown by the wind or washed by the rain right into people's front yards again. One of the samples that one of my fellow scientists collected showed plutonium and significant amounts of plutonium. He was getting 19 disintegrations per second of plutonium. And, you know, that stuff hangs around for a quarter of a million years.
That plutonium was part of the core that came out then in the explosion, correct?
Yeah. The only source it could ever have come from was inside that nuclear reactor. Fukushima City is relatively clean. It's 40 miles away from the site. So I'm with three carloads of scientists. And as we left Fukushima City, their radiation detectors were reading about 40 counts per minute. And then as we got into the hills between Fukushima City and the power plant, the radiation detectors went up to 400, 10 times what it was in the city. And there's heavy snow everywhere. There's at least a foot of snow in the mountains. So that's acting as shielding and preventing these numbers from even being higher. We went out to a incinerator. It's under construction. And they plan to burn 10 tons a day of material. Well, there's 30 million tons of material up here. So that means they'll have it all done in 3 million days. That's a long, 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 long time. 1,000 years.
1,000 years?
Yeah, this incinerator's not working yet, but their throughput is estimated to be 10 tons a day. All of those particles are up there in the hills, and there's no way that any number of human beings could go up into an entire mountainside. Some of these mountains are 8,000 feet high. To go up into them and clean a mountain range is just beyond the capability of human beings. So what happens is every time it snows or every time it rains, it washes down into these villages and it washes down into the Pacific. In these hills around Fukushima, there's monkeys. And we saw one today, as a matter of fact, running across the road. And one of the scientists watched the monkey poop and then collected the poop. And the monkey poop had 50,000 becquerels per kilogram of cesium in it. So, you know, these animals that are living up there in the forests are becoming more and more and more highly radioactive. You know, the impression I get is the futility of the cleanup. I mean, these areas that scientists I'm with sampled today were supposedly clean, and they're highly radioactive again. This deep sadness of seeing these beautiful family homes just abandoned and likely to remain abandoned for a lifetime. So the futility and the sadness, I think, are the two things that weigh on me the most as I go to bed tonight.
That was part of the first phoned-in report by Arne Gundersen. He is on a one-month journey to Japan to assess the status of the cleanup of the Fukushima accident. From here, he will travel on to Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Kobe, Kyoto, and the Osaka Global Environmental Forum. Gundersen is chief engineer of Fairwinds Associates, and on the board of directors for Fairwinds Energy Education. That's a 501c3 nonprofit. Just before leaving for Japan, Arne Gundersen sat down with the staff of Fairwinds Energy Education, his wife Maggie, and Toby Aronson and Caroline Phillips. They went over the information that is so crucial in understanding the current situation in Japan. First, here's Arne Gundersen addressing the claim by TEPCO that the cleanup of the land around the Fukushima power plants is well underway, facilitating a possible return of some of the evacuated residents.
The country's seriously contaminated even now. People that live in the prefecture are living in what we would call an RCA, and that stands for a radiologically contaminated area. If that were in the States, if that were in a nuclear power plant, those kinds of levels of radiation would require that you couldn't walk into those areas without health physics support.
Currently, there are a lot of people who are dislocated, but are people also returning to these contaminated areas as well right now?
Yeah, I think they're being forced to go back in. You got to remember, there's 160,000 people that were evacuated originally, and now the number's just a hair under 100,000. So 60,000 have gone back into areas that we would consider, by United States standards, highly contaminated. But what the Japanese did was they raised the standards, and they took away the money from these people when they were in housing, not in the prefecture. So they said, if you want to continue with the stipend we have you on, you've got to go home. So it's basically they're forcing them back into an area that's much more radioactive than it was when they left.
So Arne, not only are people moving back into contaminated areas, but we also have some nuclear power plants in Japan starting up again. Can you talk about some concerns regarding that issue?
Yeah, Toby, that's a great question. You know, there were 54 nuclear power plants in Japan operating right before the Great East Earthquake and the disaster at Fukushima Daiichi. Well, there were 4 units that Daiichi wiped out, plus there were 2 others that will never start again. Plus, there were 4 others just down the road at Fukushima Daini. So 10 nuclear reactors will essentially never operate again because they're in Fukushima Prefecture. In addition, at least another 10 or 15 are too old to operate and should have been shut down even before the earthquake. So that 54 units has tumbled down to about 26. Of those 26, the Japanese are frantically trying to get them back up and running. And the real reason behind it all is, you've heard it before, money. The banks have put a lot of money into maintaining those 26 power plants and paying for the staffs to sit there essentially idle for the last 5 years. They want their money back. And the only way to get their money back is to turn those nukes back on. So what's happened in the last 5 years is that the Japanese haven't really made these plants any stronger. What they've done is they've reanalyzed all of their calculations and taken away all the margins of safety and said that, well, a stronger earthquake, these plants can withstand. But in fact, there's been no major changes to the structure. It's frightening. You know, these plants were built by people my age when we got out of college in the 70s. They're old. And the Japanese refuse to acknowledge that it was a bad bet then, and they're going to double down on a bad bet now. The Abe regime is very pro-business, and the banks have deep inroads into the Abe regime. And on top of that, the 10 utilities that run all of the power grid in Japan are little fiefdoms that have incredible pressure in their parliament, Diet. So politically, the pressure from the banks, the pressure from these 10 power companies, Tokyo Electric is only one of 10, and the Abe regime are totally ignoring what the public wants. And you're right, it's at least 70% of the Japanese, including almost every woman and just about half the men, don't want nuclear power to operate again, but it's being ramrodded through by financial interests that just don't care about public health and safety.
When there were no nuclear reactors in Japan going, I never read about any blackouts or power outages. And my question is, how is Japan meeting its energy needs without all of the nuclear reactors that haven't been restarted either, or will not be restarted? Are they necessary?
Yeah, there's a couple of answers to that, Caroline. It's a great question. The first is that the Japanese power grid is really nowhere near a world power grid. They have 10 little fiefdoms, and they don't share power across the grid. So you've got TEPCO to the north and Chubu to the south of Tokyo, and each has an enormous overcapacity in case one unit goes down. In the United States, we have a shared grid. We pool our power. In Japan, they don't. Matter of fact, in Western Japan, they're at 50 cycles per second, and in Eastern Japan, they're at 60 cycles per second. So they can't even agree on how many cycles per second the electricity should flow at. So when all these units shut down, there's a lot of excess capacity sitting around anyway. And it was largely gas and largely coal. So what happened is two things. First, and the Japanese really deserve an enormous amount of credit, they conserved like crazy. They really went on an efficiency kick. I was in office buildings where the temperature inside was 78 in the summer. And it wasn't bad. You know, they realized that they were overcooling in the summer and overheating in the winter. So the Japanese really went into an energy efficiency and a conservation mode. They did import more coal and gas. And then they also brought in the equivalent of about 6 nuclear power plants worth of solar power. So they're beginning already to displace with solar power these old nukes. And you're right, there were no blackouts. Tokyo remained well over-illuminated, trust me, and life went on.
Arnie, I have a follow-up question to that. You touched on solar. What is the actual progress with renewables?
Well, there's enormous pressure by these 10 utilities that we talked about. You know, the 10 governing electric boards, essentially, are putting enormous pressure on the diet so that renewables are being stifled. But even despite that, people are doing it, and corporations are doing it. You know, the interesting thing is that even before the disaster at Fukushima Daiichi, Japan had the highest electrical rates in the industrial world. And that's an incredible burden. And now they're going to be higher because they just paid for 5 years of nuclear plants that didn't run, and they want that money back too. So electric costs in Japan are arbitrarily high because these 10 powerhouse utilities control the diet, control the parliament, and the people are getting stuck with high rates. So now we've got high rates that they pay for out of their wall socket, and they're realizing, heck, I can go off the grid and put a solar collector on and get it cheaper. So they've priced themselves to a point where new solar is much, much cheaper than what they can get from the grid. And the big industries are realizing it too. The big industries are building their own power plants or building their own solar collectors so that they don't have to pay these exorbitant rates that the Japanese are being charged.
Arnie, moving on to issues regarding the outpour of radiation into the Pacific Ocean, there's been a lot of debate on exactly how contaminated is the Pacific Ocean. Is it affecting our food? Is it affecting our water quality?
Yeah, Toby, the Japanese are focusing on leaks from the Fukushima power plants. And, you know, that's probably a mile of coastline, and it is severely contaminated, and it continues to bleed into the Pacific every day. But what no one is paying any attention to is that the entire mountain range that runs 100 miles up and down this coast is also contaminated. And as much radiation is pouring out into the rivers and streams, into the Pacific from the mountain range because it's so contaminated, as from the Fukushima site. So, you know, Tokyo Electric would have you just look at the site and say, well, we're doing things to collect the radiation. But in fact, they've got an entire state pouring radiation into the Pacific. So what's in the Pacific? Off of California, they're finding radiation at what I would consider significant levels. A cubic meter is about 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet. And in a cubic meter of ocean water, they're finding 10 radioactive decays every second. That's called the disintegration. So that's called 10 becquerels per cubic meter. So a cubic meter of water, if you were in a dark room, would have 10 flashes of light every second. And that's going to go on for 300 years. So we have contaminated the biggest source of water on the planet, and there's no way to stop it.
So are you saying that the contaminated water problem is hopeless?
It used to be that scientists believed dilution is the solution to pollution. But I think we're finding with the biggest body of water on the planet that you can't dilute this stuff. And we're going to begin to see this bioaccumulation, which is all the fish that are in the ocean are going to uptake the cesium and the strontium and become more and more and more radioactive.
Arnie used the term bioaccumulation. If you could explain to our audience what exactly that means and sort of what that implies as far as, you know, food quality goes or water quality.
Well, if you think of it as there's radiation on the bottom of the Pacific, and that gets picked up by the whatever's on the bottom, the seaweed. And then little fish eat the seaweed, and little fish get eaten by bigger fish. And those fish get eaten by still bigger fish.
The circle of life.
Right. You know, and that process, every time they do that, the cesium in the little fish gets concentrated in the bigger fish. It's not just radioactivity. We know that about the mercury that's in tuna. The coal plants have thrown mercury out into the oceans, and it works its way up the food chain, too. So this concept of bioaccumulation doesn't just apply to radiation, but it is applying to fish in the food chain now.
I know that I haven't heard anything announced by the FDA, and I'm not a believer that the FDA would automatically say anything, but I know we don't have any substantiated radio levels in our seafood coming to the United States, but what is your stance? Do you eat out and take Maggie out to sushi regularly for bits of yellowfin tuna?
You know, the FDA limit is so high. It's 12 times higher for Americans than what it is for Japanese. So basically, if the Japanese find a fish that they can't eat, they can ship it to America and feed it to us, and the FDA doesn't care. So we've got a really high threshold. And on top of that, the FDA is hardly sampling fish at all. Less than a tenth of a percent of the fish that come into the United States are tested. Really, really small number. So my decision is I'm not eating fish from the Pacific. That's a personal decision. I never did eat yellowfin tuna, by the way, because they're such a beautiful fish. I just really couldn't stand, you know, killing one.
Arnie, while you're in Japan, I know that a number of presentations are set for you and you'll be traveling all over. In your presentations, what are you specifically talking about to these groups?
Yeah, the first thing I'll be talking about in Japan is the use of plutonium in their nuclear reactors for fuel. They call that MOX, a mixed oxide fuel, but it's uranium and plutonium together inside a nuclear reactor. Running a reactor on plutonium is, one, really technically complicated, and two, expensive. There's not a reactor in America that uses MOX fuel, and there's none in the pipeline either. Why? Because our utilities are trying to minimize the cost, and it's actually cheaper to use uranium than it is for mixed oxide fuel. In Japan, they don't care. You know, as we talked about at the beginning here, the utilities that own these power plants have control over the rates. So they're paying more for this plutonium fuel. In America, not a power plant in the country uses plutonium for fuel because it's more complicated to license. And after a nuclear accident, it also complicates the accident analysis. So it's a real mess using plutonium. And I really want to talk about how I think it's a bad decision that plutonium will be used in Japanese reactors.
What do you think is the terrorist risk with MOX reactors?
You know, there's some brilliant people, and Frank von Hippel is probably at the top of the list at Princeton, who have been saying for 20 and 30 years that having plutonium driving down the highways to fuel a power plant is a real terrorist risk. And the reason is that if you capture a truck that's got plutonium and uranium in it, you can chemically separate out the plutonium and make a bomb. You don't need a real fancy gaseous diffusion plant and billions of dollars. You can chemically pull out the plutonium and make a bomb.
That was a conversation with Arne Gundersen that included Maggie Gundersen and staff at Fairwinds Energy Education. As a young man, Gundersen believed in the promise of nuclear power. He was a licensed reactor operator and managed projects at 70 nuclear power plants in the U.S. However, he became increasingly more aware of the high risks while at the same time observing serious safety breaches. He spoke out and became a whistleblower. After 20 years as nuclear engineer and executive, Gundersen was fired from his job in 1990. My thanks to Fairwinds and Maggie and Arne Gundersen for the material in this radio program that was recorded by them in February 2016. You can find the full podcast of their conversation and the phone calls from Japan on the website of fairwinds.org. That's Fairwinds with an E, F-A-I-R-E, winds.org. Fairwinds website has information on uranium mining and fuel, design and construction, decommissioning of nuclear power plants, and on waste and spent fuel. The Gundersens are also reaching out to many other experts with interviews and references to their work. You can subscribe to podcasts on their page, fairwinds.org. Come back for TUC Radio's next broadcast for an up-close interview of Arne and Maggie Gundersen. I finally met them in person when they came to California for a November 2015 speaking tour. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.